Just as the realization struck Obah that he would never again have to go in the barn and see the mound of frozen muck that he hadn't been able to dislodge with the scoop shovel, despite the ranting insistence of his lunatic mother, it occurred to him that if he had used the pickaxe, that would have made quick work of it. Well, wasn't that just something? Chapter 14. With an easy but flawlessly precise turn of his wrist, Friedrich Gilder lifted a leaf of gold on the fine hairs of the brush and laid it over. The gold, light enough to float on the gentlest breath of air, drew down onto the wet gesso as if by magic. Leaning over his workbench in concentration, Friedrich used a sheep's wool pad to carefully rub the freshly gilded surface of the small stylized carving of a bird, checking for any flaws. Outside, the rain occasionally tink-tink-tinked against the window. Though midday, when the prowling clouds passed bearing fits of rain, it darkened as if to dusk. From the back room where he worked, Friedrich glanced up, looking out through the doorway into the main room, watching the familiar movements of his wife casting her stones over the grace. Many years ago he had gilded the lines of her grace, the eight-sided star within a circle, within a square, within another circle, after she had properly drawn it all out, of course. The grace would have been useless had he drawn it. A grace, to be real, had to be drawn by one with the gift. He enjoyed doing whatever he could to make things in her life a little more beautiful. She was what made his life beautiful. He thought that her smile had been gilded by the Creator himself. Friedrich saw, too, the woman who had ventured to their home for a telling lean forward expectantly, absorbed in watching the fall of her fate. If they could really see such things, people would not come to Althea for a telling, yet they always watched intently as the stones rolled from his wife's long, slender fingers and out across the board upon which was drawn the grace. This woman, middle-aged and widowed, was a pleasant sort, and had been to see Althea twice before, but that had been several years back. As he had concentrated on his own work, he'd absently heard her tell Althea about her several grown children who were married and lived close to her, and that her first grandchild was on the way. Now, though, it was the drop of stones, not a child, that held the woman's interest. "Again?" she asked. It was not a question so much as astonishment. They did it again. Althea said nothing. Friedrich burnished the freshly laid gold as he listened to the familiar sounds of his wife gathering up her stones from the board. "Do they do that often?" the woman asked, her wide eyes turning from the grace to Althea's face. Althea didn't answer. The woman rubbed her knuckles so hard that Friedrich thought the skin might come off. "What does it mean?" "Hush," Althea murmured as she rattled the stones. Friedrich had never heard his wife be so uncommunicative with a customer. The stones clacking in Althea's loose fist seemed to have an urgency to their bony knock. The woman rubbed her knuckles, awaiting her destiny. Again, the seven stones rolled out across the board, come to divulge the holy secrets of the fates. From where he sat, Friedrich couldn't see the stones fall, but he could hear the familiar sound of their uneven shapes rolling across the board. After all these years, he rarely watched Althea practice her profession, that is, watched the stones themselves. He did, though, despite the years, savor watching Althea. As he looked out, seeing the side of her strong jaw, her hair still mostly a golden sweep, down past her jaw, falling like sunlight over her shoulder, he smiled. The woman gasped, "Again!" As if to make the woman's point, thunder in the distance rolled over the house. "Mistress Althea, what could it mean?" Her voice carried the unmistakable timbre of apprehension. Althea, on her pillow on the floor, leaning on one arm, her withered legs out to the side, used the arm against the floor to straighten herself. She finally looked at the woman. "It means, Marjorie, that you are a woman of strong spirit." That's one of those two stones, me, a strong spirit? That's right, Althea confirmed with a nod. And the other, then? It can't be good, not there. It can only mean the worst. I was about to tell you that the other stone which follows with each throw is also a strong spirit, a man of strong spirit. Marjorie peered again at the stones on the board. She rubbed her knuckles. But they both, she gestured, they both keep going out there, to beyond the outer circle, to the underworld. Her troubled eyes searched Althea's face. Althea pulled on her knees, drawing her legs before herself to cross them. Though her legs were withered and nearly useless, crossing them before her pillow on the floor helped her sit up straight. No, 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 my dear, not at all. Don't you see? This is good. Both strong spirits going through life together, and together ever after. It's the best possible outcome of a telling. Marjorie cast another worried look at the board. Really? Really, Mistress Althea? You think it's good, then, that they keep doing that? Of course, Marjorie. Good it is. Two strong spirits joining. Marjorie touched a finger to her lower lip as she peered up at Althea. Who is it, then? Who is this mystery man I'm to meet? Althea shrugged. Too soon to tell. But the stones say you will meet a man. She made a show of putting her first and second fingers tight together. And you two will be fast with each other. Congratulations, Marjorie. It looks as if you are close to finding the happiness you seek. When? How soon? Again Althea shrugged. Too soon to tell. The stones only say will, not when. Maybe tomorrow, maybe next year. But the important thing is that you are near to meeting a man who will be good with you, Marjorie. You must now keep your eyes open. Don't hide yourself away in your house, or you will miss him. But if the stones say he is strong and he is open to you, but they don't fix it sure. That's up to you and the man. Keep yourself open to him when he comes into your life, or he may pass without seeing you. I will, Mr. Althea. The conviction in her voice strengthened. I will. I'll stay prepared so when he happens into my life, I'll see him, and he'll see me just as the stones foretell. Good. The woman fished around in the leather purse hanging from her belt until she found a coin. She handed it over eagerly, pleased with the outcome of her telling. Friedrich had watched Althea give tellings for nearly 4 decades. In all that time, he had never before seen her lie to someone. The woman stood, holding out her hand. May I help you, Mistress Althea? Thank you, my dear, but Friedrich will help me later. I want to stay with my board for now. The woman smiled, perhaps daydreaming of the new life waiting for her. Well, then, I'd best be on my way before it gets any later in the day, before nightfall. And then it's a long ride back. She leaned to the side and waved through the doorway. Good day, Master Friedrich. The rain rattled against the window in earnest. The sky, he noticed, had darkened, casting a gray gloom over their place in the swamp. Rising from his bench, Friedrich waved. Let me see you to the door, Marjorie. You do have someone waiting to take you back, don't you? My son-in-law is up at the rim of the canyon where the path starts down in, waiting with our horses. She paused in the doorway and gestured to his work on the bench. That's a fine piece you've made. Friedrich smiled. I hope to find a customer at the palace who thinks so, too. You will, you will. You do fine work. Everyone says so. Those who own a piece of your work count themselves as lucky. Marjorie curtsied happily to Althea, thanking her again before retrieving her lambskin cloak from the hook by the door. She smiled out at the angry sky and donned the cloak, drawing its hood over her head, eager to be on her way to find her new man. It would be a long journey back. Before closing the door, Friedrich warned Marjorie to be absolutely certain to stay on the path and to watch her step up out of the canyon. She said she remembered the instructions and promised to follow them with care. He watched her hurry off, disappearing into the shadows and mist before closing the door tight against the foul weather. Silence settled once more inside the house. Outside, thunder rumbled in a deep voice, as if in discontent. Friedrich shuffled up behind his wife. "Here, let me help you to your chair." Althea had gathered up her stones. Once again they rattled in her hand, like the bones of spirits. As considerate as she always was, it was unlike her not to acknowledge him when he spoke. It was even more unlike her to cast her stones again after a customer left. Casting her stones for a telling called upon her gift in ways he could not fully understand, but he did understand how it fatigued her. Casting her stones for a telling drew down her strength so that it left her detached from the world and wanting anything but to cast them again for a while. Now, though, she was in the spell of some tacit need. She turned her wrist and opened her hand, casting the stones at her board as easily, as gracefully, as he handled his ethereal leaves of gold. Smooth, dark, irregular-shaped stones rolled forth, bouncing on the board, tumbling across the gilded grace. In their life together, Friedrich had seen her cast her stones tens of thousands of times. There were times when, much like her customers, he had tried to discern a pattern in the fall of the stones. He never could. Althea always did. She saw meaning no mere mortal could see. She saw in the random fall of the stone some obscure omen only a sorceress could decipher. Patterns of magic. There was no pattern expressed through the act of the throw. It was the fall of the stones that was touched by powers he dared not consider, powers that spoke only to the sorceress through her gift. In that random motif of disorder, she could read the flow of powers through the world of life and even, he feared, the world of the dead, although she never spoke of it. Despite how close they were in body and soul, this was one thing they could not share in their life together. This time, as the stones rolled and wobbled across the board, one stopped in the exact center. Two stopped on opposite corners of the square where it touched the outer circle. Two ended up at opposite points where the square and the inner circle touched. The final two stones came to rest beyond the outer circle, which represented the underworld. Lightning flashed, and seconds later thunder clapped. Friedrich stared in disbelief. He wondered what the odds were of the stones coming to the end of their tumble at these specific points on the grace. He had never before seen them end in any discernible pattern. Althea, too, was staring at her board. "Have you ever seen anything like that before?" he asked. "I'm afraid so," she said under her breath as she raked the stones up with her graceful fingers. "Really?" He was sure he would have recalled such an unlikely event, such a startling orderliness. "When was that?" She rattled the stones in her loose fist. "The four previous throws. That casting made five, all the same, each individual stone coming to rest in the identical place it had before." Again she cast the stones at the board. At the same time, the sky seemed to open, letting rain roar down on the roof. The noise reverberated through the house. Involuntarily, he glanced toward the ceiling briefly before watching along with Althea as the stones rolled and bounced across the board. The first stone rolled to halt in the exact center of the grace. Lightning flashed. The other stones, rolling in what looked to be a completely natural manner, came to rest in what appeared a perfectly normal way, except that they stopped in the exact same places they had before. "Six," Althea said under her breath. Thunder boomed. Friedrich didn't know if she was speaking to him or to herself. "But the first four throws were for that woman, Marjorie. You were casting them for her. This is for her telling." Even to himself, it sounded more like a plea than reason. "Marjorie came for a telling," Althea said. "That does not mean the stones chose to give her one. The stones have decided that this telling is for me." "What does it mean, then?" "Nothing," she said. "Not yet, anyway. At this point, It is only potential, a thunderhead on the horizon. The stones may yet say this storm is to pass us by. Watching as she gathered up her stones, he was overcome with a sense of dread. Enough of this. You need to rest. Why don't you let me help you up now, Althea? I'll make you something to eat. He watched her pluck the last stone, the one in the center, off the board. Leave your stones for now. I'll make you some nice hot tea. He never before thought of the stones as anything sinister. Now he felt as if they were somehow inviting menace into their lives. He didn't want her to cast the stones again. He sank down beside her. Althea? Hush, Friedrich. She spoke the words in a flat tone, not in anger or reproach, but simple necessity. The rain drummed against the roof with rabid intensity. Water cascading off the eaves roared. Darkness out the windows faltered in fits of lightning. He listened to the stones rattle, like the bones of the dead speaking to her. For the first time in their life together, he felt a kind of defensive hatred for the seven stones she held, as if they were some lover come to steal her away from him. From her seat atop her gold and red pillow on the floor, Althea cast the stones down onto the grace. As they tumbled across the board, he watched with resignation as they came to rest, natural as could be, in the exact same places. He would have been surprised only if they had fallen differently. Seven, she whispered. Seven times seven stones. Thunder rumbled in a deep resonant tone, like the voice of discontent of spirits in the underworld. Friedrich rested a hand on his wife's shoulder. A presence had come into their home, invaded their lives. He couldn't see it, but he knew it was there. He felt a great weariness, as if all his years had come at once to weigh him down, making him feel very old. He wondered if this was in some small way what she felt all the time when she became so weary from casting a telling. He shuddered to contemplate, always swimming in such emotionally turbulent waters. His world, his work of gilding, seemed so simple, so blissful, in its ignorance of the swirl of tempestuous forces all around. The worst of it, though, was that he could not protect her from this unseen threat. In this, he was helpless. Althea, what does it mean? She hadn't moved. She was staring at the smooth, dark stone setting on her grace. One who hears the voices is coming. Lightning ignited in a blinding, angry flash, illuminating the room with white incandescence. The scintillating contrast between bright light and smothering shadow was dizzying. The intense strike flickered on as thunder crashed with a boom that shook the ground. A ripping crash followed on its heels, the clamor adding a confusion of sound to match the flashing of light. Friedrich swallowed. Do you know which one? She reached up and patted his hand, resting on her shoulder. Tea, you say? The rain gives me a chill. I'd like some tea. He looked from the crinkled smile showing in her eyes to the stones on the grace. For whatever reason, she wasn't going to answer that question, for now. He asked her another instead. Why did your stones fall like that, Althea? What does something like that mean? Lightning struck nearby. The crack of thunder felt as if it split air made of solid stone. Fists of rain beat against the window in petulant fits. Althea finally looked away from the window, from creation's fury, and turned back to the board. She reached out and placed her forefinger on the stone in the center. The Creator? He guessed aloud, before she could name it. She shook her head. Lord Rahl. But the star in the center represents the Creator, his gift. It does, in the grace. But you must not forget this is a telling. This is different. A telling only uses the grace. And in this telling, the stone in the center represents the one with his gift. Then it could be anyone, Friedrich said. Anyone with the gift. No. The lines coming from the eight points of the star represent the gift as it passes through life, through the veil between the worlds, and beyond the outer circle into the underworld. Thus, it represents the gift in a sense that it conveys with no other person. The gift for magic of both worlds, the world of life and the world of the dead. Additive and subtractive, this stone in the center touches both. He glanced back at the stone in the center of the grace. But why would that mean Lord Rall? Because he is the only one born in 3,000 years with both aspects of the gift. In all that time until he came into his gift, no stone I have cast has ever landed in that place. None could. What has it been, 2 years now, since he succeeded his father? Less, since his gift came to life in him. Which in itself leaves questions with only troubling answers. But I recall you telling me years ago that Darkon Rall used both sides of the gift. Gazing off into dark memories, Althea shook her head. He also used subtractive powers. But he did not do so by birth. He offered the pure souls of children to the keeper of the underworld in return for the keeper's favors. Darkon Rall had to trade for the limited use of such powers. But this man, this Lord Rall, has been born with both sides of the gift, as those of old were. Friedrich wasn't sure what to make of that, what danger it could be that he so strongly felt. He remembered quite distinctly the day the new Lord Rall had risen to power. Friedrich had been at the palace to sell his small gilded carvings when the great event had taken place. That day, he had seen the new Lord Rall, Richard. It had been one of those moments in life never to be forgotten, only the third Rall to rule in Friedrich's lifetime. He remembered quite clearly the new Lord Rall, tall, strong, with a raptor gaze, striding through the palace, seeming completely out of place, and at the same time belonging. And then there was the sword he carried, a legendary sword, not seen in Dahara since Friedrich had been a boy, way back before the boundaries had been brought into existence, cutting Dahara off from the rest of the new world. The new Lord Rall had been walking through the corridors of the people's palace along with an old man, a wizard, people said, and a sublime woman. The woman, with long, lush hair wearing a satiny white dress, made the grandeur and majesty of the palace seem dull and common by comparison. Richard Rall and that woman seemed right together. Friedrich recognized the special way they looked at each other, the commitment, loyalty, and bond in the gray eyes of that man and the green eyes of that woman was as profound as it was unmistakable. "What of the other stones?" he asked. Althea gestured out past the larger circle of the grace, where only the gilt rays of the Creator's gift dared go, to the two dark stones sitting in the world of the dead. "Those who hear the voices," Althea said. He nodded, at having his suspicions confirmed. In such things dealing with magic, it wasn't often that he was able to guess the truth from what appeared to be obvious. "And the rest?" Staring at the four stones resting at the cusps of lines, her voice came softly, mingling with the rain. "These are protectors." "They protect Lord Rall?" "They protect us all." He saw then the tears rolling down her weathered cheeks. "Pray," she whispered, "that they are enough, or the keeper will have us all."
"You mean to say there are only these four who protect us?"
"There are others, but these four are pivotal. Without them, everything is lost."
Friedrich licked his lips, fearful of the fate of the four sentinels standing against the keeper of the dead. "Althea, do you know who they are?" She turned then, putting her arms around him, pressing the side of her face to his chest. It was as childlike a gesture as he could imagine, one that touched his heart and made him ache with his love for her. Gently, he put protective arms around her, comforting her, in spite of the fact that in truth he could do nothing to protect her from such things as she rightly feared.
carry me to my chair, Friedrich? He nodded, lifting her in his arms as she hugged his neck. Her withered, useless legs dangled. A woman of such power as could enforce a warm and rain-swept swamp around them in winter, yet she needed him to carry her to a chair. Him, Friedrich, a mere man she loved, a man without the gift, a man who loved her. You didn't answer my question, Althea. Her arms tightened on his neck.
One of the four protective stones, she whispered, is me.
Friedrich's wide eyes turned back to the grace with the stones upon it. His jaw fell open when he saw that one of the four stones had crumbled to ash. She had no need to look.
One was my sister, Althea said.
Cradled in his arms, he felt her grieving sob.
And now there are three.
Chapter 15. Jensen moved out of the way of the flood of people flowing up the road from the south. Huddling close to Sebastian for shelter from the wind, she briefly considered simply curling up on the frozen ground, off to the side and going to sleep. Her stomach grumbled with hunger. When Rusty stepped sideways, Jensen slid her grip up on the reins closer to the bit. Betty, her eyes, ears, and tail alert, pressed up against Jensen's thigh for reassurance. The footsore goat occasionally huffed her annoyance at the passing throngs. When Jensen patted her fat middle, Betty's upright tail instantly became a wagging blur. She glanced up at Jensen, swiped her tongue out for a brief lick of Rusty's muzzle, and then folded her legs to lie down at Jensen's feet. As his sheltering arm enclosed her shoulders, Sebastian eyed the wagons, carts, and people moving past on their way toward the people's palace. The sound of the wagons rumbling by, people talking and laughing, feet shuffling, and horses clopping, all melded together into a steady drone punctuated by jangling metal and the rhythmic squeaking of axles. The clouds of dust lifted by all the movement carried the aroma of food along with the stink of people and animals and left the taste of dirt on her tongue.
"What do you think?" Sebastian asked in a low voice.
The cold sunrise bathed the distant sheer cliffs of the huge plateau in glowing lavender light. The cliffs themselves rose what seemed thousands of feet from the Azrith Plains. But what man had made atop them rose higher yet. Countless roofs behind imposing walls collected together into the massive structures that was a city founded on the plateau. Low winter sunlight lent the soaring marble walls and columns a warm glow. Jensen had been little when her mother had taken her away. Her childhood memory of having lived here had not prepared her adult sensibilities for the actual splendor of the palace. The heart of Dahara stood noble and proud, triumphant above a barren land. Her awe was dimmed only by the taint of it also being the ancestral home of the Lord Rahl. Jensen swiped a hand over her face, closing her eyes briefly against her pounding headache, against what it meant to be the prey of Lord Rahl. It had been a difficult and exhausting journey. After they had stopped each night, Sebastian used the cover of darkness to scout while she started to make camp. A number of times he had rushed back with the horrifying news that their pursuers were closing in. Despite exhaustion and her tears of frustration, they had to pack up and keep running.
"I think we came here for a reason," she finally answered. "Now is a poor time to lose courage."
"Now is the last chance to lose courage." She studied the note of caution in his blue eyes for only a moment before answering by wading back into the moving river of people. Betty sprang to her feet, peering up at the strangers as she pressed in close to Jensen's left leg. Sebastian moved in close on the other side. An older woman in a cart beside them smiled down at Jensen.
"Care to sell your goat, dear?"
Jensen, one hand grasping Betty's rope along with Rusty's reins, her other holding the hood of her cloak closed against a cold gust of wind, smiled, but shook her head firmly to decline. As the woman in the horse-drawn cart returned a disappointed smile and started to move away, Jensen saw a sign on the cart proclaiming sausages for sale. Mistress, are you here selling your sausages today? The woman reached behind, pushed aside a lid, and stretched her hand into one of the kettles nestled snugly in blankets and cloth. She came up holding a fat coil of sausage.
Fresh cooked this morning. Could I interest you? Only a silver penny and well worth it.
When Jensen nodded eagerly, Sebastian passed the woman the coin requested. He cut the sausage in two and handed half to Jensen. It was wonderfully warm. She quickly devoured a few bites, hardly taking the time to chew. It was a relief to dull the sharp edge of her gnawing hunger. Only after those bites were down did she begin to appreciate the taste.
It's delicious,
she called up to the woman. The woman smiled, seeming not at all surprised at the compliment. Walking abreast with the cart, Jensen asked, Would you happen to know of a woman by the name of Althea? Sebastian swept a furtive gaze around at the people walking within earshot. The woman, not at all shocked by the question, leaned down toward Jensen.
You've come for a telling, then?
Although she couldn't be sure, Jensen thought it easy enough to guess what the woman meant.
Yes, that's right. Would you know where I can find her?
Well, dear, I don't know her, but I know of her husband, Friedrich. He comes to the palace to sell his gilded carvings.
Many of the people moving up the road looked to have come to sell their wares. Jensen dimly recalled when she was very young the palace being a buzz of activity, with throngs coming every day to sell everything from food to jewelry. Many towns near where Jensen had lived when she was older had a market day. The people's palace, though, was a city with the buying and selling of goods taking place every day. She recalled her mother taking her to booths to buy food and once cloth for a dress.
Would you know where we can find this man, Friedrich, or someone else who knows the way?
The woman gestured ahead toward the palace.
Friedrich has a small booth in the marketplace, up top. As I hear told, you'll need to be invited out to see Althea. I'd advise you to talk to Friedrich up top.
Sebastian put a hand on Jensen's back as he leaned past her.
Up top?
He asked the woman. She nodded.
You know, up top, where the palace is. I don't go up there myself.
Then where do you sell your sausages? He asked.
Oh, I have my cart and horse, so I stay down along the road selling to those going to and from the palace. They won't let you take those horses of yours up, if it be your intention to go look for Althea's husband. Your goat neither, for that matter. There are ramps for horses inside for the soldiers and those with official business, but wagons with supplies and such mostly use the cliff road on the east side. They don't let just anyone ride their horses up. Only the soldiers keep horses up top.
Well, Jensen said, I guess we'll need to stable them if we're to go up to find Althea's husband.
Friedrich doesn't come often. You'll be lucky to catch him on a day he's here. Best, though, if you could talk to him.
Jensen swallowed another mouthful of sausage. Do you know if he would be here today, or what days he does come to the palace?
Sorry, dear, but I don't.
The woman pulled an oversized red scarf over her head and fastened it tight with a knot under her chin.
I see him now and then, that's all I know. I sold him sausages a time or two to take home to his wife.
Jensen glanced up at the looming people's palace. I guess we'll just have to go for a look then. They weren't even inside yet, and already Jensen's heart was pounding at a furious pace. She saw Sebastian's fingers glide over his cloak, touching the hilt of his sword. She couldn't resist brushing her forearm against her side, checking for the reassuring presence of her knife under her own cloak. Jensen hoped not to be in the palace long. When they found out where Althea lived, they could be on their way. The sooner the better. She wondered if Lord Rawl was at the palace or off making war on Sebastian's homeland. She felt great empathy for his people being at the mercy of Lord Rawl, a man she knew to be without a shred of mercy. On their journey to the people's palace, she had asked Sebastian about his homeland. He had shared with her some of the convictions and beliefs of the people of the old world, their sensitivity for the plight of their fellow man, and their longings for the blessings of the Creator. Sebastian spoke passionately about the beloved spiritual leader of the old world, Brother Narev, and his disciples of order, who taught that the welfare of others was not only the responsibility but also the sacred duty of all people. She had never imagined a place with people who were so compassionate. Sebastian said that the Imperial Order was fighting back valiantly against Lord Rawl's invaders. She of all people understood what it was to fear the man. It was that fear that worried Jensen about going into the palace. She feared that if Lord Rawl was there, his powers might somehow tell him that she was near. An orderly column of soldiers in chainmail and dark leather armor rode out, headed in the opposite direction. Their weapons, swords, axes, lances, flashed menacingly in the morning sunlight. Jensen kept her eyes turned to the ground ahead and tried not to stare at the soldiers. She feared they could pick her out of the throng by sight, as if she were glowing with some mark only they could see. She kept the hood of her cloak pulled up to cover her red hair, fearing that it would attract unwanted attention. As they drew near the great portals into the plateau, the crowds grew thicker. Spread out on the Azeroth Plains to the south of the cliffs, vendors had set up their stalls in makeshift streets. Those newly arrived settled in wherever they could find room. Despite the cold, everyone seemed in a good mood as they went about setting out their wares. Many were already doing a brisk business. Daharan soldiers seemed to be everywhere. They were all big men, all wearing the same orderly leather, chainmail, and wool uniforms. All were armed with at least a sword, but most carried additional weapons, an axe, spiked mace, or knives. While the soldiers were alert and watchful, they didn't appear to be bothering the merchants or hampering their business. The woman selling sausages waved her good wishes to Jensen and Sebastian before she pulled her cart off the road at an empty space beside three men setting out casks of wine on a short table. The three men, with the same strong jaws, broad shoulders, and tousled blonde hair, were obviously brothers.
"Careful who you leave your animals with," she called after them.
Many of the people who set up their stands down on the plain had animals, and it seemed easy enough to conduct business where they were, rather than go up to the palace. Other people roamed the crowds, hawking items to passers-by. Perhaps their simple wares sold better to those come to the open market. Some, like the woman with the cart, came to sell food they had cooked, and since there were plenty of people down below, they had no need to go up inside. Jensen suspected that others were content to be away from what was sure to be the greater scrutiny of officials, and yet more guards, in the palace proper. Sebastian took it all in without looking obvious. She imagined in his gaze a running tally of troops. To others, it would appear, he was merely looking about at the merchants, enticed by the variety of wares for sale. But Jensen saw that his vision focused beyond, to the great portals between towering stone columns. "What should we do with the horses?" she asked. "And Betty?" Sebastian gestured to one of the enclosures where horses were picketed. "We're going to have to leave them." In addition to being so close to the home of the man trying to kill her, Jensen didn't like being among the press of so many people. She felt so flush with the sense of danger that she couldn't think straight. Leaving Betty at a stable in a town was one thing, but leaving her lifelong friend out here, among all these people, was something else. She pointed with her chin to the scruffy men minding the livestock enclosure. They were busily engaged in a game of dice. "Do you think we can trust the animals to people like that? They could be thieves for all we know. Maybe you could stay here with the horses while I go look for Althea's husband." Sebastian turned back from his survey of the soldiers near the entrance. "Jen, I don't think it's a good idea to separate in a place like this. Besides, I don't want you going in there alone." She gauged the concern in his eyes. "And if we get into trouble, do you really think we could fight our way out?" "No, you have to use your head. Keep your wits about you. I've brought you this far. I'm not going to abandon you now and let you go in there alone." "And if they draw swords on us?" If it came to that, fighting wouldn't save us in a place like this. It's more important to give people a worry, make them think twice about how dangerous you might be, so that you don't end up fighting in the first place. You have to bluff.
I'm not any good at that kind of thing.
He grunted a short laugh. You do it well enough. You did it with me that first night when you drew the grace.
But that was just with you, and with my mother there. That's different than in a place with so many people.
You did it at the inn, in the way you showed the innkeeper your red hair. Your manner loosened her tongue, and you kept the man at bay with nothing but your bearing and a look. All by yourself, you gave all those men worry enough that they left you alone. She had never thought about it in that way. She viewed it more as simple desperation than calculated deception. As Betty rubbed the top of her head against Jensen's leg, she idly stroked the goat's ear and watched as the men left their game of dice to take horses from travelers. She didn't like the rough way the men handled the horses, using switches instead of a steady hand. Jensen scanned the crush of people until she spotted the red scarf. She coiled the slack out of Betty's rope and started off, pulling Rusty along with her. Surprised, Sebastian stepped quickly to catch up. The woman in the red scarf was setting out pots with her sausages when Jensen reached her.
Mistress?
She squinted in the sunlight.
Yes, dear. Some more sausages?
She lifted a lid.
They are good, aren't they?
Delicious. But I was wondering if you would accept a payment to watch our horses and my goat?
The woman replaced the lid.
The animals? I'm not a stableman, dear.
Jensen, holding the rope and the reins in one hand, rested her forearm on the side of the cart. Betty folded her legs and laid down beside the wheel.
I thought you might like the company of my goat for a while. Betty is a fine goat and wouldn't cause you any trouble.
The woman smiled as she peered down over the edge of her cart.
Betty, is it? Well, I could watch your goat, I guess.
Sebastian handed the woman a silver coin. If we could picket our horses with yours, it would put our minds at ease that they were in good hands and that you were keeping an eye on them. The woman carefully inspected the coin, then appraised Sebastian more critically.
How long will you be? When I sell my sausages, I'll want to be heading home after all.
Not long, Jensen said. We just want to go find the man you told us about, Friedrich.
Sebastian, in an offhand manner, pointed at the coin the woman was still holding. When we get back, I'll give you another to thank you for watching our animals. If we don't get back until after your sausages are all sold, then I'll give you two for your trouble of waiting on us. Finally, the woman nodded.
All right, then. I'll be here selling my sausages. Tie your goat to the wheel there, and I'll keep my eye on her until you get back.
She gestured over her shoulder.
And you can put your horses with mine, there. My old girl would enjoy the company.
Betty eagerly took the small chunk of carrot from Jensen's fingers. Rusty nudged her shoulder, insistent that she not be left out. So Jensen let the horse have a piece of the rare treat, then passed a chunk to Sebastian, so an ever-eager Pete wouldn't be left out.
If you lose track of where I am, just ask around for Irma, the sausage lady.
Thank you, Irma. Jensen smoothed Betty's ears. I appreciate your help. We'll be back before you know it.
As they mingled into the crowd funneling toward the great plateau, Sebastian put his arm around her waist to keep her close beside him as he escorted her into the gaping maw of Lord Rawl's palace. Jensen could hear in the distance Betty's plaintive bleating at being abandoned. Chapter 16. Soldiers in polished breastplates, all carrying upright pikes with razor-sharp edges glinting in the sunlight, silently studied the people entering between the great columns. As their scrutiny turned toward Jensen and Sebastian, she made sure not to look them in the eye. She kept her head down and moved in step with the other people shuffling past the ranks of soldiers. She didn't know if they paid any particular attention to the two of them, but none reached out to seize her, so she kept moving. The huge, cave-like entrance was lined in a light-colored stone, giving Jensen a sense of passing into a grand hall rather than through a tunnel, into a plateau the size of a mountain. Hissing torches in iron brackets set into the walls lit the way with a dotted line of light. The air smelled of burning pitch, but it felt warm inside, out of the winter wind. To the sides, cut into the rock, were rows of rooms. Most were simple openings with a short front wall behind which vendors sold their wares. Walls in many of the rooms were decorated with brightly colored cloth or painted planks, offering a welcoming touch. It had appeared that anyone outside could set up shop and sell their goods. Jensen imagined the vendors inside had to pay rent for the rooms, but in return, they had a warm and dry place in, out of the weather to do business, where customers were more willing to linger. Clumps of chatting people waited near the shoemaker to have their shoes repaired, while others lined up to buy ale or bread or steaming bowls of stew. Another man with a sing-song voice that attracted throngs to his booth sold meat pies. At one jammed and noisy place, women were having their hair pinned up or curled or decorated with bits of colored glass set in fine chains. At another, they were having their faces made up or their nails painted. Other places sold beautiful ribbons, some cut to look just like fresh flowers to adorn dresses. By the nature of many of the businesses, Jensen realized that a lot of the people wanted to look their best before going up to the palace, where they meant to be seen as much as they meant to look. Sebastian seemed to find it all as astonishing as she did. Jensen stopped at a booth with no customers, where a small man with a lasting smile was setting out pewter mugs. "Could you tell me, sir, if you know of a gilder named Friedrich?"
"No man by that name down here. Finer work like that is usually sold up top."
As they were swallowed deeper into the underground entrance, Sebastian's arm returned to enclose her waist. She found comfort in his close presence, his handsome face, and those times he smiled at her. His spikes of white hair made him different from everyone else, unique, special. His blue eyes seemed to hold so many answers to the mysteries of the larger world she had never seen. He almost made her forget her heartache at missing her mother. A succession of massive iron doors stood open, admitting the advancing throng. It was intimidating going through such doors, knowing that if they closed, she would be trapped inside. Beyond, wide marble stairs, paler than straw and swirled through with white veins, led up to grand landings edged with massive stone balustrades. In contrast to the immense iron doors into the plateau, finely crafted wooden doors closed off some of the rooms. Whitewashed corridors, well lit by reflector lamps, distracted from the feeling of being inside the plateau. The stairs seemed endless, in some places branching off in different directions. Some of the landings opened into spacious passageways, the destination for many of the people. It was like a city in eternal night, lit by the wall lanterns with reflectors and pole lamps by the hundreds. Along the way were beautiful stone benches where people could rest. On some levels were more small shops selling bread, cheeses, meats, some with tables and benches set outside. Rather than feeling dark and forbidding, it seemed cozy inside, perhaps even romantic. Some passageways, barred by huge doors and blocked by guards, appeared as if they might be barracks. In one place, Jensen glimpsed a spiral ramp with troops moving down on horseback. From her childhood, Jensen only dimly recalled the city under the palace. Now, with the endless new sights, it was a place of wonder. As her legs grew weary from the effort of climbing the stairs and traversing passageways, it occurred to her then why many of the people chose to remain down on the plain to do business. It was a long way up, both in distance and in time, and quite the labor. From the conversations she overheard, many of the people who came would lengthen their stay at the palace that was a city by taking rooms. Jensen and Sebastian were finally rewarded for their effort when they emerged once again in the daylight. Three tiers of balconies fronted with roped columns supported arched openings looked down on the marble hall.